Welcome to The Spot, KALW's showcase for the best in public radio podcasts. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is One with Farai, a part of Soundworks from PRI. On our show, we get a previous guest to ask a question of our current guest. Take a listen.
What was the most epiphanal moment in your life that made you know the most about yourself and the most that you wanted to do?
And here's how today's guest answered.
When I picked my daughter up from a summer camp down at Stanford University, I guess the epiphany happened and later on the ride home when I asked her about, you know, her experiences during that week and how did she feel in the class, how were the instructors, yada, yada, all the things that a parent would ask. And she told me, well, the class was great, but, you know, sometimes the instructor didn't really pay too much attention to the girls in the class and they really spent a lot of time focusing on the boys.
On One with Farai, we're speaking with Kimberly Bryant, a technologist and the founder of Black Girls Code. That's an organization that's teaching young ladies across America how to be a vital part of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So, Kimberly, let us know how you got into founding Black Girls Code, and also, what do you think about the broader issue of women and girls in STEM and what needs to be done right now?
I think we're really at a turning point where we need all hands in and solving this issue of the lack of women and the lack of representation from underrepresented minorities in the tech industry. I think one of the things that was most startling to me when I started on this path was to find that the number of women had drastically decreased from when I received my degree in electrical engineering. In mid-80s, that was the peak of women receiving computer science degrees, and they were receiving about 30%. But when you look at the statistics now, they're only receiving about 10 to 13%, depending on which study you look at. So to see the nation and the world be at this really turning point where we're at what many believe is this next revolution in terms of technology, and to see women have substantially less of a seat at the table as they did, you know, a couple of decades ago, is a true issue. I think from that standpoint, it's imperative that we have both educational institutions from K through 12 through post-secondary and graduate institutions, government, we need parents, we need corporations, we need community organizations such as ours. We really do need all of these resources really focused on finding solutions to this issue. So in some ways, there may be policy issues in terms of how schools are funded and what type of curriculum are in schools that must be addressed from the government side. From a corporate industry, we really need to get changing the environments in corporate America right now. So it's more engaging and more welcoming to both women and a diversity of individuals that are coming to the table. From community organizations, there definitely is room for more groups and organizations like myself to really focus on this problem. We can only do so much as a one nonprofit organization, but there's so much room for many to step in and do this work. And I think it really is going to take all these different resources, attacking the problem from many different angles to really move that needle.
An associate of mine interviewed your daughter, the inspiration for your organization, at an event that the White House sponsored to try to deal with this question of how to get more women and girls into STEM fields. I mean, what was it like for you that day, and both of you being seen as people who are resources as America and the world examines this issue?
I think one of the most rewarding pieces of my work is that I'm able to address an issue that's important to me and also to see that issue through the eyes of my daughter. So being able to take my daughter with me to the White House or being able to take my daughter with me to a conference in London, those have been some of the most rewarding experiences of my life. It really makes me both proud and it also is very humbling to see these things play out in my daughter's eyes. She really is my motivation and my inspiration and my muse for doing this work. But I also see it changing her self-perception of herself. It's becoming empowering in a way that mothers and daughters don't often get to share.
So why did you specifically want to make your organization, which has gotten a lot of grant funding and did a successful crowdfunding round for over $100,000 and, you know, has gotten very broad support, why did you want to make it Black Girls Code?
Well, when the idea first came to really create this organization to focus on getting girls of color into the technology space, there was this whole process where we went through this ideation phase of trying to figure out what would we call it. And I remember vividly having a list of names, Girls Technology, Girls Who Code, I think, was on that list. I found it recently. It's like, oh, we actually had that name. But eventually we landed on Black Girls Code. And I sat on that name for a while. And I remember being at a blogger conference here in the San Francisco Bay Area and being in a session where there was this panel of women leaders talking about, you know, leadership and social impact and change management and change leadership. And I waited, you know, very patiently until the end of that panel and went to speak to one of the panelists who really made an impression on me during that day. And she was actually a Filipino sister. And I said, you know, I have this idea and I've been sitting on it, but, you know, I really want to get your opinion on this name because I'm a little bit uneasy about the name, you know, and I want to make sure, you know, what do you think? And so I shared the concept with her and I shared the name of Black Girls Code. And literally in the middle of this conference, she said, I love it. You know, it speaks to me. I think it's badass. I love this name. You need to sit down right now and we're going to look. You go to, here's how you go to FTC and look and see if you can trademark this name. It was available. And she was like, I want you to go home and I want you to start the trademark on this name. I also want you, you know, to get every domain and I want you to do it tonight. I mean, you need to do this. I love it. You know, I am a Black girl and, you know, I get it. And that was like the extra validation that I needed to see someone that didn't look exactly like me, but that got it. It's about, you know, really stating an affirmation that not Black girls can or may be code, but this is something that they do. So it's really like painting a path for the future that this is what they do and it's changing. It's really pushing against that paradigm, that dominant narrative that says Black women don't do technology or Black girls are not geeks or Black girls are not into gaming. It's pushing against that narrative in a very upfront and real way.
So take me through what a Black Girls Code program is. And so a girl who's, let's say, 12 years old shows up. How long is she with you and what is she going to learn to do and what kind of environment is it?
Sure. So our program, or I say our flagship program, is a one-day program, a one-day workshop. So in these one-day classes, we could be building a web page, we could be working on robotics, we could be building a video game, or we could be building a mobile application. So it just really varies in terms of the different type of workshops that we do. And then we really split the girls off into age groups, and we take them into the classrooms. And one of the unique things about our classrooms and our environment, we think the secret sauce is really not just what we do in the classroom, but how we do it. So in our program, we have women that are software engineers, women that are technologists that actually teach the classes. So right away, not only do the girls see other girls that look like them that are into video games, and not only do they see other girls that are into some of the same geek things like Dr. Who that they're into, but they also see women that are also into some of these things. And that is like really important. Because they see a reflection of themselves and the future of what they can become and what they can do. And it's all project-based. So at the end of the day, they're either coming together as a team with a web page, they're coming together as a team with a mobile app, or whatever it is that day, a video game, but it's really project-focused. One of the last workshops that we did in Dallas, we were just so surprised that at the end of the day, the girls have finished their presentations and the families kept us in the room for almost an hour later, asking and parents asking all kinds of questions and just really excited about what they saw the girls be able to do in the course of that day and asking for ways to, you know, keep this momentum going. And that is something that really warmed our hearts as instructors and as the leaders of the local organization there in Dallas to see this work and the look on the parents' faces and how excited and engaged they were about what we were able to accomplish and create with their kids.
So how do you keep the momentum going, you know, after they may have had a wonderful immersive experience, but in order to do what you did, and we'll talk more about this, but, you know, to become an engineer and a manager in a technology space, there's a lot of steps between that and entering the field. So how do you advise them to keep the momentum going?
Well, our goal, and one of the reasons we start so early in the pipeline, we start with girls as young as 6 and 7. Our goal is to stay with our girls all the way through high school until they graduate and go to college, and then hopefully have them come back into Black Girls Code as mentors and instructors themselves. So we really do consider ourselves a full pipeline program. So our workshops and our classes run year-round. The hope and the goal for the future strategy for Black Girls Code is to eventually get our programs also into school districts. We are working and having discussions on how to make that possible. And we also, you know, continue other ways to mentor our girls. So that is evidenced in some ways by mentorship programs and internship programs that we've done with some of our corporate partners. Some of the unique opportunities that we give our girls to, like, both go visit other tech companies like Facebook and ThoughtWorks. And that's a lot of key to kind of like nurturing this talent and really providing opportunities for them to continue to grow and to really flourish and blossom in the skill sets that they have. So we've seen girls that have come through our programs and, you know, have learned one technology. Maybe they've learned how to build a mobile app, or maybe they've learned some of the game development tools that we've taught, but have taken that outside of Black Girls Code to do study on their own. So we have girls that have on their own develop games that they put in the Google Play Store and the iTunes Store. We've had girls that have gone on to do teaching themselves or enroll in other classes that are actually for adults to learn how to program in Ruby on Rails, or how to program in JavaScript, and how to program in Python. So we really want to see our program as planting a seed and just find ways to nurture it until they get through this pipeline and really see them kind of like take off and go from there.
How many cities or areas are you in these days?
We're currently in 7 U.S. cities across the U.S., so Bay Area, New York, Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, Memphis, Tennessee, and Las Vegas. And we're also in one international location currently, which is in Johannesburg, South Africa. But we're hoping to continue to expand. We have a list probably of 50 or more cities, and I always say, you know, I get at least one or two emails every single day from a parent or an educator or libraries and universities that want to see us bring the program to their areas.
So how did you get into engineering?
I was a huge watcher of Perry Mason as a kid. That's really old school, but I love the show, and I just loved everything about what I saw about being in the courtroom and arguing these cases and defending your clients. I loved it. So I really spent all of my time as a young person growing up thinking I would go to school and I would become a lawyer. But what happened by the time I got to middle school and definitely high school, I had a really strong aptitude in math and science. And so that evidenced itself by me going into like the AP science class and doing AP calculus before I graduated. And my guidance counselors really directed me to pursue a degree in college in engineering as opposed to like doing pre-law. So I chose to major in electrical engineering as opposed to doing pre-law or poli-sci once I went to school at Vanderbilt University. And it was very difficult, but I found myself in engineering, and I was really just too stubborn to quit. And I had to finish. And so I did. And I went into electrical engineering and had a very long and very successful career in industry and being in the engineering department at several major corporations, and then finding at the end of my career that I ended up back in the technology department of my current employer, and kind of rediscovering all of those computer science classes that I had taken in college, and really seeing the possibilities to use technology as a driver for some of the things that I really want to do after I left corporate America.
Yeah, I actually took, my mom was very much about enrichment. And so one of my enrichments was taking a computer coding class at the local community college when I was in high school. And it was literally one of those card machines. It was like back in the day. And we also did some stuff on the early desktop computers. But I've kind of dropped that. I learned HTML 20 years ago because I wanted to make websites. But what do you think the value is to people who are not in the technology industry of learning to code or learning more about technology, not necessarily to use it for work, but just because we live in this digital age?
I definitely think that learning little pieces of technology cannot hurt. I hesitate to say that everyone should learn to code, although I do say every young person should learn to code, because that is just the world that they live in now. Technology really drives every industry, every single occupation. So even if the students that are coming through our classes or similar classes do not become software engineers, the tool, having that tool in their tool belt, just gives them that extra leg up. So knowing the engine behind the things that they're working on or others are working on to drive their ideas forward, that gives them that extra little bit of leg up and being able to really be successful. Now, for the general population, I think that it also helps to understand what the technology is that runs behind all these things that we use every day, that we interface with every day. But I think there's room also for English majors. I think there's room for sociology majors. I think it takes a lot more than just computer science to make the world go round. But I think because technology touches so much, having at least a basic knowledge of what it's all about can do nothing but help.
So if you can imagine your daughter being your age and project out into her future, what might, or rather, who might she be when she's your age?
What I see for my daughter is a young woman that will grow into her own, being really confident and having knowledge of the possibilities of what she can become, many ways that I didn't have growing up. So I didn't have the benefit of seeing many women that look like me that were leading companies. She has that opportunity. I didn't have the ability to see many women that look like me that were doing non-traditional roles or are going into non-traditional careers. She has that opportunity. So I really do see her as being the leader and the CEO or the founder of some technology company in the future, or some major organization in the future. I would love for her to be the executive director of Black Girls Code, although she told me she would probably be too busy running her own company to be able to do that.
She turned and you down conditionally.
She turned me down. She did. She turned me down, and I'm okay with that. But I just see her definitely being able to be a really strong leader and setting a bit of a different paradigm in place about what women can do in this space and what women of color are capable of.
So, Kimberly, before I let you go, I would love you to play a little game we have on One with Farai called Exquisite, where the last guest asks a question of the current one, and that's you. So take a listen.
What was the most epiphanal moment in your life that made you know the most about yourself and the most that you wanted to do?
So I believe the most eye-opening moment for me was a day in 2011 in the summer when I picked my daughter up from a summer camp down at Stanford University. And this was her very first time, first of all, being away from home for the summer. And she was 12 at the time. So it was a long and rough week for me as a mom, just from that standpoint. But it was also her first opportunity to go into an environment where she would learn to become a digital creator by taking this computer science coding camp and being able to really immerse herself in learning to code and learning how to create games and this tool that she really loved. And the look on her face when she came out of class was just exhilarating, because I could tell immediately that this was an incredible experience for her and that it really had changed her view of what she could accomplish and what she could achieve. And that was fantastic. I guess the epiphany happened then later on the ride home when I asked her about, you know, her experiences during that week and how did she feel in the class? How were the instructors? Yada, yada, all the things that a parent would ask. And she told me, well, the class was great, but, you know, sometimes the instructor didn't really pay too much attention to the girls in the class. And they really spent a lot of time focusing on the boys. So I didn't really think I got as far in some things as I could have because, you know, the instructor didn't pay attention to us. And at that very moment, you know, my heart drops. And I knew at that moment, and I had been thinking about this idea with Black Girls Code for several months by that time, you know, because we the idea started in February. This was now June. But by that time, I knew that I had to push this idea forward because I never wanted there to be another occasion where my daughter was being able to discover herself and really being able to be the best she could be. And I didn't ever want the environment to be something that would discourage her from that path.
Well, we're not quite done yet. We have one last piece of housekeeping, which is that just as you got a question from someone else, you get a chance to ask a question of someone who you don't know, and you can ask them anything. So what would you like to ask?
I'd like to ask, what is it that motivates you to keep going, to keep pushing through the fog, keep pushing through the issues, and really keep your eyes focused on the prize?
That's perfect. You'll find out the answer to Kimberly's question on the next episode of One with Farai. And Kimberly Bryant of Black Girls Code, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure, as always.
You've been listening to One with Farai, part of Soundworks from PRI. I'm your host and executive producer, Farai Chidea. This program is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Our theme music is by the band Betty. Catch the next installment of One with Farai when I talk with David D. Healy and Shizu Yuasa, two journalists in Tokyo.
One with Farai is supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
What's that you playing?
You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts.
This is Blank on Blank, distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. I'm David Gerlach. So what is happiness? Can we ever truly be happy, or does the past always creep in and drag us down? Those are the questions the late Philip Seymour Hoffman pondered during a conversation recorded back in 2012. Here is the tape.
I would definitely say pleasure is not happiness, because I think I kill pleasure. Like I take too much of it in and therefore make it unpleasurable. Like too much coffee and you're miserable, you know. And that I do that to pleasure often, you know. And so I don't think, yeah. And there is no pleasure that I haven't actually made myself sick on.
Philip Seymour Hoffman in conversation with philosopher Simon Critchley on stage at the Rubin Museum of Art in New York City.
I have thought a lot about this actually in my life lately, to be honest, and gotten nowhere with it in a way that meaning that there's a period of time in your life where I kind of look back and I think, was I happy or was I just not aware?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And
it
seems like a very basic question, but I really do think that you reach a time where you go, I don't know.
Yeah.
And it really does upend a lot of things. But in my life now, I think I have three children, and I think I'm happy when I'm with them and they're okay. When I see them enjoying each other in front of me, then they let me enjoy them in turn. That brings a feeling which I would say is happiness. Now, yeah. I don't know why. I mean, I do know why, obviously, right. on the surface, because they're my kids. And mm-hmm. But it is a certain thing that happens, and I'm like, right now, this right. is it. But there are moments when something else creeps in there, and I'm not conscious of the love. I'm conscious of something else, which happens to be my own childhood. Having a kid always takes you back to being a kid somehow, and they really are showing me a child that I might not have had in some way. But if something else creeps in, it becomes a different kind of reflection, which is of your shortcomings, your inadequacies, your incapabilities, your powerlessness, and on and on and on, which wakens up a whole other thing. And that's what I mean about happiness. Does that mean it ended? And that gets so discouraging to me about, well, what is this thing? You know, life, people always say life is short. That's kind of the phrase. Life is short, time is short. And it does. As we get older, time does quicken. It's long, and it's long right. pertaining to that thought that the past is not done with you because you can't get rid of it, and so therefore it just starts to drag. Yeah. You get a glimpse of what you might have wanted or what it could have been, and you could start to have it right here in your life now. But then the past does creep in pretty quickly, and that is a very difficult one. And how to keep it there and not have it kind of ruin it.
If we're so keen on being happy, why do we spend so much time in the dark watching actors as brilliant as you portraying miserable creatures?
And that's what I'm talking about, is if I don't allow people to somehow identify with the worst inside themselves, they never have a chance at actually walking out with that person in their heart. You know, or in their minds, you know what I mean? They're too easy to dismiss. It's like, it might not be the thing they'll admit to a friend, you know what I mean? But if you're honest, you kind of probably do. I do. Because that's the thing with meditation too, right? That if you meditate every day and you really get into meditation, meditation is actually coming right up to the lip of death and saying, I'm here, I'm scared. That's life. That if you can actually live in that place, that's where happened, right? I mean, it's yeah. the same kind of thing. That the learning how to die, you know, and therefore is learning how to live.
You can watch the animated version of this episode on our website, blankonblank.org. It's our series with PBS Digital Studios. Be sure to also check out the rest of the conversation with Philip Seymour Hoffman online at rubinmuseum.org/talks. All right, that's it for now. I'm David Gerlach. Keep listening.
You've been listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts. Learn more about these and other great radio podcasts at KALW.org.